not necessarily those of Fresh Air Incorporated, its staff, or its board of directors.
Hi, this is Al McFarlane, host of The Conversation with Al McFarlane. You're listening to 98.3 FM, KFAI, Minneapolis.
And you're listening to Fresh Air Community Radio KFAI 90.3 FM Minneapolis, St. Paul, and around the world at KFAI.org. I'm over here breathing hard because I'm just running from the office. But yeah, it is time for the conversation with Al McFarlane. And yeah, it's also our spring membership drive. So what we're going to do right here is we're going to have a quick message from Al, and then time for our feature broadcast. But once again, 612-375-9030, or you can give online at kfai.org.
I want to begin by acknowledging that we are in the middle of Pledge Drive here at KFAI. And Pledge Drives means it's your time to show up and support, to add your voice and your support to this program, The Conversation with Al McFarlane, and to our station, our mission, KFAI. You know, let me say it again. I'm going to second that motion by saying the magic words again. Go to our pledge line, 612-375-9030. And that's if you're listening here in Twin Cities, but you're anywhere in the world, because we are global with KFAI.org. No matter where you are, go to KFAI.org and pledge to support this program and to support KFAI and The Conversation with Al McFarlane. I'm Al McFarlane. Welcome to The Conversation with Al McFarlane. I'm glad to be here and glad to have you along today. As always, this program is what I promise to deliver as a robust conversation, a conversation that means something, that's important, that's fulfilling for me as an interviewer and hopefully to you as a viewer and a listener. We're talking about something that matters in our community, and that's our economic development, our training and preparation, our capacity to engage and shape families, futures, careers, and community in ways that are productive and wholesome. I'm pleased to have as my guest today one of the architects of change and development in our community. He's Leroy West. He's the president and chief executive officer of Summit Academy OIC right here in North Minneapolis. Summit is an accredited 501c3 nonprofit and career technical education institute that has advanced economic equity in the Twin Cities and across the entire state of Minnesota for nearly three decades. It offers 20-week trainings in construction, in healthcare, financial services, information technology, and it supports low-income adults in launching careers, all at no cost to the trainee. And so, you know, right now, students can even learn or earn their GED through the Summit Academy's 10-week accelerated GED preparation program. We'll learn more about that in a minute. So West has led a storied career at Summit over the past 20 years. He's a veteran there. Prior to stepping into the role of president and CEO in 2022, he served as Summit's chief administrative officer, where he drove a 400% increase in enrollment, expanding from 200 to 1,000 students annually. Wow. Most recently, he's reestablished Summit as a leading workforce solution for employers seeking skilled and determined talent building a much-needed talent pipeline for generations to come. He's a graduate of Minnesota State University at Mankato. He's raised three sons here in Twin Cities. He's passionate about creating opportunities to help people move up into the middle class. Brother Leroy West, good afternoon. Welcome to the conversation with Al McFarland. Let me say that I want to thank our friends and partners and supporters at U.S. Bank. This edition of the conversation with Al McFarland is powered by U.S. Bank. Brother Leroy West, good afternoon.
Great. Good afternoon. And thank you so much for having me.
Well, thank you for being here. You know, this is a long overdue conversation, but one that I say is going to be good because we need to talk. And now we're having the opportunity to share what I call an intimate conversation with thousands of people connecting with us via our social media platforms. We're streaming this program not only on KFAI, where the broadcast takes place, but also across several social media platforms, LinkedIn, Facebook, YouTube channel for Insight News, YouTube channel for the Black Press of America, the National Newspaper Publishers Association, Twitter. We'll also be cutting this interview up into small pieces that we send out as shorts across social media. And we'll be posting these on platforms like TikTok even. So we're getting the word out. And it's an important word. Let me have you start by giving sort of a OIC Summit Academy 101. What's the vision? What's the mission in your words?
Well, you know, Summit is, as you said before, is how we move people out of poverty into the middle class. I mean, that's definitely what we like to do. And we always say the best social service program in the world is a job. And we coined that phrase, you know, years ago. And, you know, we take someone, you know, who has been, you know, looking to advance themselves, you know, to take care of themselves and their family, and they might not have any skills. They can come to Summit and we provide that education and training, and we connect them to those employers. So part of us is how we become a workforce solution institution for this region and to help those who move from poverty and into the middle class.
This organization started, I think, in 1964, and OIC, Opportunities Industrialization Centers, was the umbrella national organization. Reverend Leon Sullivan, they called him the Lion of Zion, out of Philadelphia, originated the organization. What do you know about the founding, the initial vision, and what the discussion was at the time in 64 about workforce, about opportunity, about how do we break our people out of systemic poverty and into productivity, into the middle class?
Yeah, I mean, if you go back to Dr. Reverend Leon Sullivan, I mean, he had the Sullivan Principles, you know, as well. And it's about how, you know, back then in the 60s, he was, you know, working with employers there, you know, to try to get those who are unemployed and underemployed and moving them into the workforce. And he, back in the civil rights movement, you know, he was a strong leader back then, and he actually led a protest against 400 different businesses back there that wouldn't hire, you know, those folks of color. So, you know, especially one of the boycott was against Tasty Cakes. And what they did, they came to the table and said, what skills do you have? And he was like, what skills do you need? Mm-hmm. So then the OIC was born from there. And that concept mushroomed not only just in Philadelphia, but throughout the country as well. So there were over 200 different OICs across the country. And, you know, Summit was one of them as well. And Summit's still standing, and well, we have 25 OICs in 19 states right now, with Summit's being one of the leading OICs in the country.
Mm-hmm. And Summit started off under a different name. Talk about who Summit began as and what was the evolution to its present name.
Yeah, so it was called Twin Cities OIC when we first started, you know, back in the 60s. And then that led to a merger in 1996. The former president, Louis King, led the merger back in 1996 with the organization he was running called Two or More and Summit Twin Cities OIC to form Summit Academy OIC. And from there in 1996 to where we are right now, you know, we've been leading the mission and moving people out of poverty.
So you've grown from a local OIC into a regional workforce development leader in Minnesota. What is the challenge? Again, I'll keep asking again and again, Brother Leroy, what is the mission? What is the need? Why is this resource necessary?
Yeah, I mean, if you go back and look at, you know, where we are, I mean, there's going to be a workforce shortage. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's it. It is coming. If you think about the baby boomers right now, I think the last age is 62. Then you have Gen Xers like me. You know, I'm in the middle of the pack, so I got 10 cycles away and then I'm out, right? So there is a huge workforce shortage. There is a need. And I'll say in the next 3 to 4 years, there's a major cliff that's coming. And we need to develop a workforce for tomorrow. Because you have, you know, your boomers are gone, your Gen Xers. The boomers sent the Gen Xers to four-year institutions. So mm-hmm. you basically then left those who are in the trades. There are a lot of jobs and skills that doesn't require a two-year, four-year, but it requires you to have a skill and still move into a career. Those jobs are there right now, and it's just expanding more and more. And you need organizations like Summit to be able to train the next workforce for tomorrow. That's what we are, and that's what we aim to do.
So, you know, I approach this, Brother Leroy, from my experience in history as a member of the civil rights movement of that era. I was a young man when Dr. Sullivan and those lion-hearted leaders challenged racial segregation, discrimination, and laid demands on society that we be acknowledged and afforded the opportunity to be productive and earn fair wages for our labor and build families and build community. And the resistance then was that there seemed to be a very cozy relationship between the systems of industry and of the marketplace of retail and banking and housing. All of it was kind of neatly stitched together with us on the outside in a pool of lack. And so our effort and our fight had been to say, you know what, we deserve the best that America has to offer as well. And so not only did we have to fight to ensure that we understood that we deserved that we understood what it meant to have and be the best, but also that the barriers outside, the cozy comfort of things being the status quo, could be challenged by us in ways that ended up improving life for everybody. As you see it, what are the barriers now? You mentioned aging out of the population, and to function fully, properly as a society, you need trained workers, and especially in the trades, and especially in the new areas of technology. And so with so many baby boomers and Gen Xs moving out, how will the next people be prepared to carry the society forward? That creates opportunity. And it further challenges the old systems of exclusion that kept us out. We are needed in a way that we haven't been before, though there still is resistance to our movement inside the arena of economic vitality and power. Am I overstating this case, or am I making sense to you?
No, you are making sense, and that's absolutely correct. I mean, he or she who control labor wins, right? If you, in terms of a business, and you can't, and there's untapped talent in the communities in which we serve. So you can't ignore that, And right now, this how the challenges is how do we now break down those barriers and create access with those employers? And Summon has been doing it over the years. Like I said, I've been here for 23 years, and we've come a long way, right? And but we still have a long way to go. But is how do we connect the community to those employers so we can be a conduit? So then when you start creating access right now and start creating talent and skills and now they're with those employers, then it's like the entrail, right? So then somebody goes in, they're going to tell somebody else in their community, and they're going to come follow them. So it's about how to, you know, the challenges, how do we continue to create this access in these various sectors in the industry? We definitely penetrated the construction industry. Mm-hmm. The construction to Summit is like Cheerios to General Mills, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, this is our flagship. So we've had 20 to 30 years to really work this out in the construction. So, you know, I can honestly, you know, say in terms of being a community-based organization, we're one of the largest community-based accredited trainers in construction in this region, mm-hmm. where we're able to connect people of color and women and move them into construction trades. Thousands. So we're proud of that. Now, how do we take that and translate to that to the financial services sector?
Before you go there, yeah. Let me think about construction a little bit too, because it drives a point home that I wanted you to make. I remember, Leroy, being involved in community protest around highway construction. And one of our leadership groups, this is like maybe 20 years ago or 30 years ago. You might have been there, you might not have been there yet. But I remember we had a traffic stoppage at the corner of where your building is on Olson Memorial Highway before you enter the freeway. We've had our cars pull up and stop traffic in the middle of the rush hour. People couldn't get downtown and they couldn't leave downtown because we had traffic blocked four ways. And we waited there. And we also had protests because there was some kind of construction going on associated with that, where we blocked construction from continuing. The idea was simply to make a point, you can't ignore us. So right. I raised this story because I wanted you to talk about what the conditions were. It's easy to think that the society has always been fair, that the principles of democracy, you know, are just stellar, but our lived experiences show that this has been a struggle from the beginning and remains a struggle. So take a minute and say what the world was like even when you grew up and got into the profession 20 years ago, and what was it like before you, from what you learned in school, what your parents said? What was the question of discrimination, equality, segregation, lack of opportunity? Describe that.
So that time that you just described was before me. let's go there. But, given the whole barriers of access, I grew up in Washington, D.C. Mm-hmm. So, I grew up in the projects in D.C. So, you know, there all around, I went to school. It was 100% African-American, right? So, and part of it is, you know, I looked at my parents and, you know, all of my siblings and my surrounding. In D.C., to be successful, you either go to the military or you're in the government. Mm-hmm. Those were the two areas that, you know, there. So in growing up in D.C., you know, those were the areas that in order to be successful, you need to get a job in the government. That's all I knew until I began to get in high school a little bit. And my parents, really, dad just had a, you know, he dropped out at the 10th grade. So he didn't have a high school diploma. My mom got her GED. She worked at the hospital center, but they had values. Mm-hmm. And they told me, they say, in order for you to be successful, son, you need to have an education. Mm-hmm. So I couldn't go outside until I did my homework every mm-hmm. day. And that was the foundation in me that really created this this inner drive to continue to do what I do right now. So what
conditions did they face? How come your dad dropped out of school? How come your mom had to get a GED? What did they tell you about that? And then talk about your grandparents who brought them, because what they did was better than their parents, I think. Tell me about it.
Yeah, well, yes. My grandparents, they came from South Carolina, and they worked in the fields, right? You know, some of them were, they farm, sold, things, vegetables and what they cropped, what they harvest, to get money. And then my dad left South Carolina because he wanted to get a better life for himself, mm-hmm. which he did better than his parents. You know, he worked for the D.C. public schools, as a custodian. But now they said they were still struggling. I mean, because they did not have the education and the skills required for those high paying jobs or those middle class jobs to get them where they needed to go. So me, I'm the first one in my generation mm-hmm. and still who have gone to college to begin to better myself. So part of it is just a lack of, nobody in front of them helping them navigate to say, show them the way. Mm-hmm. So for me, I was able to break through those barriers by going to college and getting my education and now becoming who I am. And now I set the example for my three sons mm-hmm. as well to break that cycle.
And so I don't want to leave the picture that it was any lack of either energy, intensity, intelligence on our family, our families, on our part, but there were structural barriers. And that's what they came up against, is systems that excluded and prevented us from pursuing the opportunities that we should have had. Is that correct?
Oh, absolutely. They had no access. I mean, it was structural barriers that basically locked them out, that they didn't have any opportunities. So there was a ceiling that this is how far you can go. And I think now today, and I think it's back to your previous question, is I think some of those ceilings are beginning to lift mm-hmm. is because right now, I mean, there's no help on the way. This is the talent you have, mm-hmm. right? So certainly as we begin to break down those barriers, we're beginning to see access and beginning to create some opportunities. We're still a long way. Mm-hmm. We're still having the first CEOs beginning to retire. Mm-hmm. But they're the ones who are kind of paving the way right now and not necessarily looking back and bringing people through. Now they're looking back and say, hey, wait a minute, let me go back because I created my way to get the CEO of retiring. Let me show them the blueprint mm-hmm. of creating access for others to come behind them. So we're beginning to see that now. We're beginning to see that opportunity, but it's still a long way to go. We really need to create a large network, a social network. Mm-hmm. And that's what it is. It's a social network that gives those who are aspire to be leaders in this community and this industry to help create jobs and opportunities in various sectors.
I'm Al McFarland. This is The Conversation with Al McFarland, this edition powered by U.S. Bank. We thank them for their support and sponsorship. My guest is Leroy West, CEO and president of Summit Academy, OIC, an institution that continues to make waves, opening doors and creating opportunity for our community and for society. I live in North Minneapolis, so I told you this when we talked a few weeks ago, that I drive by Summit Academy almost every day, at least once or twice a day. And I always, always, always notice that your parking lot is actually totally filled. And in fact, the access road between you and Olson Highway is lined up with cars both ways. So something, I say when I drive by, something must be going on. I mean, these cats are jammed, packed full every day. what's going on? What's happening that you've got this kind of energy and intensity at Summit Academy OIC?
This is an exciting time. This is our time. And that's what I always say. You know, when I first started 23 years ago, we were doing 168 students all year. You know, you can roll a boulder through the parking lot and it wouldn't hit a thing. So now we're doing over 1,000 students, and we're actually have plans to grow to 2,000 students on an annual basis. So now is how we want to really become, and I said before earlier, a workforce solution institution for this region. Mm-hmm. We want to produce 1,000, I'll put 1,000 graduates in jobs on an annual basis. You know, so if we have our average salary is about $45,000 a year or $50,000 in 20 weeks of training with no out-of-pocket costs. If anybody is making at least $20 an hour, somebody else in the household, now they have a household income of about $85,000 to $90,000 a year. And the median household income in the Twin Cities is around $80,000. That's to start. So over the next 2 to 3 years, can you imagine putting 3,000 of our graduates into jobs? And that's making a huge impact. So we are starting to go beyond just the construction. We have our IT, our financial services. We just launched the unlicensed dental assistant training program. It is absolutely exciting. And the electrician, we have a pre-apprentice electrician program. We enroll every 11 weeks. Right now, I mean, the electrician program is so in demand that the next enrollment for someone to get in is next fall. Yeah. Because there is a waiting list to get in. Mm-hmm. We are launching evening classes right now. It's because we're connecting with the employers right now. We're figuring it out. The employers are now hiring our graduates, and they're doing a good job. Mm-hmm. They're like, there's talent right here being produced in North Minneapolis. And we're a conduit, and we're excited right now. Like I said earlier, this is our time. There's a workforce shortage. You can't wait till the cliff comes. You need to start now.
So take a minute and shout out some of your corporate and business and industry partners. I think it's important to give them credit. You probably have some people that have been leading the way and are helping you help them meet their workforce needs. Are there any stories that are exemplary that show when the light bulb goes off at the corporate table that people discover, you know, solutions that they hadn't imagined existed before?
Whoa, wow, because I don't want to leave anybody out, right? So, this certainly is a shout out to everyone. But I would say, you know, we actually put together and I launched this new division a couple of years ago, this Workforce Solution Division, mm-hmm. to really connect with these employers, because what we're trying to do is move them from a casual relationship to a committed to a connected. And these are employers who not only just give us dollars, but also come help inform us of our curriculum so that we can produce a better employee with the competencies and skills they needed on day one. And then when three, we want to do those two and hire our graduates as well. So when you start looking at folks who are sitting in that, they're in all areas. I would like to shout out to U.S. Bank, who's been a very, very strong partner mm-hmm. With Summit, Ameriprise, Mortenson, God, I can go on and on. But those are just three right now that are just highlight that has been absolutely phenomenal in helping Summit achieve where we are today.
Well, take a minute and go over, if you don't mind, you know, how does a U.S. bank support a Summit? How does Ameriprise? How does Mortenson? And those are three different kinds of companies. One banking, obviously, one is financial services. The other is construction, Mortenson. So how does a relationship make sense to them? And I'm asking the question so that you can also invite other companies to do what these companies have done to support your students and your program.
Certainly. And again, you know, a lot of these employers, they give, you know, mm-hmm. so as I said before, no student pays 1 cent out of their pocket to attend, which is already a challenge, mm-hmm. right? So from a corporate standpoint, giving us dollars.
What would it cost if a student had to pay for the training that you give them? What would the likely fee be?
The tuition is $8,000 to attend Summit for 20 weeks.
Wow. Okay.
Yeah. Right. And that's the tuition. The cost of education is about $11,000.
Yeah. Okay.
So now we're going from $1,000 to $2,000. Uh-huh. You see what we need in order for us to basically hit those numbers. Mm-hmm. So again, those who are giving dollars, but also those who are helping us shape the curriculum. We have an industry advisory committee in the various sectors, from the dental to the medical admin to IT, financial services, all of our programs that we meet a few times a year, and we have employer partners that help us look at the curriculum, review our equipment, our trainings, and just help us to modify what needs to be modified so that we are training to today's standards. So we have that employer engagement. And at the end of the day, is hiring our graduates. It's mm-hmm. opening the door so that those students who are graduating are making a living wage job, taking care of themselves and their families. At the end of the day, that's what it's all about.
Let me throw another scenario out. As you were speaking, I remember our protest a generation ago was that when the protest on Olson Highway was because construction crews were coming in to do highways and building and development, but none of those crews contained our people. So white people came in and built the infrastructure and maintained it. And we were locked out of the opportunity to fix our own house, our own streets, our own neighborhood. And that is what we protested. We said, you know what? If we can't do this, it ain't going to be done. Right. And we had to do it in a way that got the attention of both the industry and the government. So that I think that led to, and this was all kind of led by your predecessor, Louis King, getting the attention of both the government and the big contractors, like the stadiums were being built and major arenas,
yep.
and coming up with systems to guarantee workforce participation by our people that hadn't been done before. And before, Minnesota had this smugness about it that said, oh, there's only 4% Black people in the state of Minnesota, or 2%, 1% way back when. And so we haven't got a problem. But from the members of that 1 and 2% who couldn't get a job because they're Black, there is a problem. And so somebody had to bring that together where we were not systematically ignored or marginalized while business as usual went on creating the Ozzie and Harriet good life for white folks. And having us looking in, wishing we could have a chance at owning a home in the suburbs or in our neighborhood. So the challenge addressed that. One of the things that we experienced that I've written about was, you know, when Minneapolis and neighborhood organizations needed employees, as often as not, somebody would get hired from Sauk Center or Brainerd or Duluth and come in and get a 2 or 3 year job, become an expert on poverty and Black people, right? And keep moving up the ladder and keeping us where we are. We were a problem that was nice to look at. And they would say, we're gonna solve the problem, but they admired the problem and kept us in a position of need, of deficit, and of want. We objected to that. What I hear you saying now, Leroy, is that you've created a machine that reverses the flow. That somebody coming out of Summit Academy might go to Brainerd, Sauk Center, Redwood Falls, Worthington, and create benefit and value for that community because of his or her talent, the training that he or she acquired at Summit Academy. We've changed the project, reversed the flow. What do you think about that?
Yes, the so
I'm in
so eloquently put it.
Go ahead.
So, you know, my hat goes off to, you know, my Louis King, my predecessor, and you and those who helped chop down the trees through the forest so you can have somebody like me to create the machine so that there's not enough resistance, so that the path has been cleared. Mm-hmm. And there was a lot of chopping. Believe me, I was here. and you know what? They're still chopping, right? Mm-hmm. Because there's still other sectors that we have not been able to penetrate. Mm-hmm. But certainly, we look at the flow. We wanted to create a machine big enough that you can't ignore us. Mm. You just can't ignore us. And that's why I say one of our missions is to be a workforce solution institution in this region so that so you can't ignore. When you talk about sourcing talent and where they're coming from, we want to think of Summit Academy OIC. And again, there is the labor shortage. I mean, Mother Nature is going to take care of itself, right? So there's going to be there is definitely the workforce need, and they're going to be looking for talent. So the machine that we built, and it is a machine, cranking out 1,000 graduates a year who are ready to work prime time. That's major impact. Now we're talking about impact to our community, mm-hmm. so that they're now able to get these living wage jobs and able to stay in their homes, own the homes, right, and set examples for their kids. So that's, you know, and there's a lot of hidden curriculum that exists, you know, when we're talking about placing our students and you know, creating opportunities, because it's creating a community. Mm-hmm. It's about bringing jobs, you know, taking, you know, piping into a community where it's talent, giving them the skills, attaching it to those employers, and they're coming back and creating a vibrant community on the north side. So hats off goes on to all of you who has helped us create that that path. And again, I saw it. You know, 20 years ago, it was a struggle. And I was the architect behind developing a lot of these training programs during my tenure as a chief operating officer here. Now becoming the CEO, this is our time. This is the machine that we're big enough right now that it's time for us to produce, and you can't overlook us.
I love the motto, the best social service program in the world is a job. You coined that phrase. Dig into that. What do you mean when you say it? How do you feel when you say it? How does that truth show up in the marketplace and in the lives of the people that you're training?
Yeah, so again, it's all 20-week training. So again, you have somewhat, about 80% of our students come to us, they were unemployed before they even start. So they were either on some type of a county assistance, or, you know, there was somebody either transitioning from prison. Somebody was, you know, I wouldn't say telling them what to do, but, you know, they had to report to someone, right? So now you come to Summit, we want to, for 20 weeks, we want to provide you with a skill. So now you're able to get that job or have that career. So let me change it, because we want to start talking about a career. So when you do that, now nobody be able to dictate your life. So, you know, you become self-sufficient. You start to, you know, own your own home. You hopefully begin to go out to eat, you know, take your family on a vacation, and you start doing some of those things. So we said the best social service program in the world is a job. You have that career right now, and you take away all those other things that you leave behind that you don't have to report to anyone who's dictating your life.
I looked at my notes on, again, the origin of the organization, and I want to take a minute to talk more about Reverend Leon H. Sullivan. His title or his nickname was the Lion of Zion. So Reverend Sullivan was a towering figure in Black America. He fused faith, economic justice, and global human rights into a single moral vision. He was nicknamed the Lion of Zion because of his commanding presence and his fearless advocacy. He was a pastor of Zion Baptist Church in Philadelphia and a pioneer of economic self-development as a civil rights strategy. And sort of the key contributions I think that he'll be known for, is known for, include economic activism, the founding of OICs, founding job training and Black enterprise initiatives, decades before this whole idea of inclusive capitalism emerged and entered into the mainstream. He also was a pioneer preaching about corporate accountability. He authored, as you made reference to, the Sullivan Principles in 1977. That was a code that pressured U.S. companies who were operating in apartheid South Africa to uphold racial equality, which helped accelerate global divestment from companies operating in apartheid South Africa. He expanded the reach of the movement to the global stage, and in doing so, himself served on the board of General Motors, mm-hmm. one of the first Black Americans to do so, and he leveraged that company's corporate power to achieve social change. That's power. Social change by being a director of General Motors Corporation. And at the end of the day, everything rode on, rested in the idea of moral authority. He was a preacher whose pulpit extended from neighborhood streets to international forums and always insisted that dignity requires ownership, skills, opportunity, and not symbolism alone. What a powerful man. You know, and as I think about him, I'm reminded, and you and I both, maybe we mentioned this briefly before this program, of the passing yesterday, Tuesday, of the Reverend Jesse Jackson, one of the leaders of the civil rights, human rights, and economic rights movement in our country that I think was kith and kin to what Reverend Sullivan was doing with the OICs. So I just want to take a second just to acknowledge that all around the country, all around the world, people are acknowledging the debt of gratitude and appreciation for the fearlessness, the leadership, the voice of Jesse Jackson that we think is in the same vein as Leon Sullivan, the same vein as Dr. Martin Luther King, the same vein as Marcus Garvey, Malcolm X, all these fearless fighters. And what that means to me, to us, I believe, brother, is that we can continue to grow ourselves into fearless men and women. Men and women who are fearless, who are convicted with the belief that our dignity is not negotiable, that we are here because we're supposed to be here. And our presence is a blessing to the planet and to humanity. And our voice is a voice of healing and a voice of inclusion, a voice of health. We represent what the potential for democracy to be, but that is not fully formed. It's still a work in progress. And we understand that. And yeah. we work towards that. And we work with an idea that we're not attempting to displace or replace or eliminate or disadvantage anybody else. We believe that with cooperation and with intention, we can simply create systems and models of support, of innovation, of growth that allow us all to live better and to live in accordance with the harmonics of nature itself. That's what I think. What do you think? Got me preaching over here. But
I'm about to say, just continue. You. No, Al, I mean, I, you know, certainly, you know, echo everything that you just mentioned there. And, you know, again, you know, you look at history there and we have to say who's in line, right now to carry the torch, mm-hmm. right? And we have to continue to keep the flame burning, because if not, that flame go out and you see things in reverse, and it will reverse. So on understanding the progress that has been made, we can't reverse back. We have to continue to move forward with that. And we have to continue with that same agenda and spread it so that it's not only with our own peers, but be able to educate those who are coming behind us as well. I look at the Gen Xers and the Gen Zs and, the millennials, and all of those Xers, right? How do we create the blueprint right now so that we accelerate faster? Because we've learned through the process right now of what, the leaders before us and what they've endured and the challenges that they face. Lots of challenges and lots of barriers. So I certainly echo what you were saying, there, and I wanted us to continue to drive and to move forward and to advance African Americans and advance all people. And how do we look at this whole inclusion so that we could become a better country and a better world?
I want you to give a special shout out, if you would, to your predecessor, Louis King, Louis J. King II. And I think he did a marvelous job in shepherding, molding the merger of two or more and some of the and TCOIC into Summit Academy, and has gone on to have a national responsibility. Talk about that. Talk about what it was like to work with him. Louis was a military man. I think, like me, he was a Morehouse man, I believe.
And yes, he was.
Also in the military. So he had a certain attitude about the way he did things, and I appreciated that. But talk about him and his vision and how he was so successful, I think, in bringing people to the table.
Louis just has a knack right now of turning a no to a yes, right? and he has such a vision right now, and he was very strategic, right? Very strategic. And working with him, I learned so much from him. And, by him, but right, just with Summit, again, we were 168 students when we first started. He was in a political and strategic space. I was in the operational and tactical. So as we began to form that bond between he and I had skill sets that he didn't have, right? I had patience, right? I had the patience, but let me tell you, from a political and a strategic standpoint, you talk about a visionary, absolutely phenomenal at that. And we were looking at things, we were always two to three years out, and we were working to plan. We planned to work and we worked to plan.
And I remember visiting Louis in his office down at your place there, and always had a whiteboard and always drawing, mapping it out.
And the same thing I learned is absolutely the same thing from him, and he's doing the same thing at the national level, mm-hmm. as well. But he's doing it on a bigger scale, right? Mm-hmm. So you're looking at the OICs and how he moves the mission, and as you said before, we took at Reverend Leon Sullivan, how he was a visionary, and. Mm-hmm. With his passing, unfortunately, the OICs really didn't have that type of leader, in which we lost a lot mm-hmm. of ground. So now he was tapped on the shoulder to help to bring that back. Mm-hmm. So he's at the national level in that movement right now and really trying to mobilize all the OICs and gaining us, together again so that we can continue to carry out the legacy of Dr. Reverend Leon Sullivan.
How do people support you? I know you're looking for and have received and continue to seek corporate support, but how else can citizens support you outside of becoming students and beneficiaries of the training you provide? Is there a public information or public awareness or a public voice that ordinary people can bring to support your work, either in the corporate space or in the government space? I know that workforce is a big issue with the state of Minnesota, and that's one of the things that Lewis did, is set up visibility in partnership with the Department of Employment and Economic Development and other departments, right? That's how the thing with the highway department became so big. Your signature success was highways and, I believe, the Viking Stadium and a couple other big projects like that, where you understood that there was a public element for these developments that required attention and access to our people in a place where we were overlooked because our voices were not heard, we were not seen in previous generations. We together made ourselves visible and undeniable, and change has taken place, and there's still more to do. But and I forgot the question I was going to ask about there, but I'm trying to paint this picture of leverage and working with the government in particular. So how do citizens support your work in the public space that continues to grow resources for you to do the work you're doing? That's the question.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's just continue to be an advocate, right? Understanding, don't ignore the problem. Is how do we continue to create a solution to the problem? And then the problem is there is a workforce shortage. Mm-hmm. And where are you going to source your talent? So the fact that is, from the employer base, because employers right now, they're looking at what their workforce is going to look like for the next five to 10 years. Mm-hmm. So they're planning that right now. How do they groom internally? Where do they get their bench strength from coming through? The same thing in the public sector, and what are some of the policies that exist? And there could be policies that are out there that could be holding back opportunity to advance. Mm-hmm. Our graduates. Mm-hmm. So, how do we now be an advocate so that we get our students in faster, or get communities of color, or those who may not have a 4-year degree or 2-year degree, but they have a certificate in skills to be able to qualify for certain jobs, right? So, and they have the talent to do so. So how do we continue to advocate for that and open up and change policy so that more of our graduates can move into those careers?
I didn't ask you about the demographics. Who are you serving? Tell me about the demographics of the populations that you serve, and where do you see that evolving to as you go from 1,000 to 2,000 in the next several seasons?
You know, it's been interesting because in all of my years here at Summit, it has always been the same, where 80% of our students come from Minneapolis and the surrounding suburbs. The other 20% is from St. Paul and the surrounding suburbs. Okay. So, and that number has not changed. But how do we want to continue to penetrate?
Describe the student. Are the students primarily African-American or international or mostly men, mostly women? How old, how young, what's the profile?
Sure. So our average age is about 27 years old. Mm-hmm. And 85% of our students are students of color. Mm-hmm. African-American sitting at about 65% of that population is about African-American. And then it's a mix of all of the other there. So, but we have students,
And by mix, you mean probably Native American, Somali,
Hmong, Native American, Somali, Hispanic,
international, Latino. International.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. So, and we have students coming from 100 different zip codes, mm-hmm. from 100 different zip codes that they drive in. And the more and more they're hearing a Summit, is because of our training. And that's what we're becoming known for, is we're becoming an institution where we produce good trainers and good graduates are the, you know, people are referring, even employers are referring students to come to Summit. You say, you go get the training here at Summit, because hey, when you come in, it's 20 weeks, it's a grind. You come in here, you take your hats off, pull your pants up, address each other as sir and ma'am, right? So when you come in week one, by week 20, you're going to be work ready, and you're going to be ready to go. So teaching the skills is one thing, right? That helps you get the job, but the soft skills help you keep it. So that's also infused in what we do as well. So you talk about the demographics, they come from all walks of life. You know, someone who is could have, you know, tried a 2-year, 4-year, they dropped out for whatever reason. You could have someone who wanted to change a career, someone who's transitioning from prison, or somebody just been sitting on mom's couch for 4 or 5 years trying to figure out what they're going to do with their life, right? They come from all walks of life. So that's who we serve.
Are you destroying myths about who we are? Here's the question. For a long while, when the marketplace wouldn't hire our people, they had an excuse saying, we can't find them, first of all. Number two, they say, oh, they don't want to work. And they said that so much that we ended up saying it, oh, they don't want to work, you know? And so we see our own people, and if they weren't wearing the heart at the time and had a bus corner, we'd just write them off even quicker than the outside society wrote them off. So somehow we've got to break that mental picture, that limitation that we have pulled up and put on ourselves, and that sometimes we fight to keep it on. So how do you deal with that, the mentality, both of individuals who have this baggage that they bring, but also the baggage in the community that reinforces the idea that our people don't deserve, or are not willing, or are not capable, or are not able to be productive, functional, and successful? How do you break that?
Maybe
I'm overstating it now.
You're actually, you know, saying it correctly. But what we've seen, that I would say 15 years ago, we had to battle a lot of that, right? We would place our students with an employer, and, you know, they, you know, just not hitting the ball, right? And we hear all these things, okay, we're not going to hire you because of those things. But what we're able to do over the course of, and I was very intimate in developing this, is what are the standards? What are the standards right now, regardless of who it is, if you it doesn't matter. And what you do is you engage employer partner. That's why you come in, you have engagement, say, what are the standards right now? Because they can tell us what we don't know. Then we're able to incorporate that in the training. So we have a 70% success rate. So you got the 30% right now, they drop off for all type of reasons. But there's reasons because they're just not ready yet. You have to hit the ball in order for you, when you get to that 20-week mark, that means you've been vetted through our system and that you're ready to go play. So the fact that is, it's how do we continue to break that myth, right, is producing a qualified individual, and you're placing them and with those employers. And employers, and how do you create a raving fan? And that's what we want to do. When we place them, so the employers are like, wow, we follow up. They want more. So then they're exposed to a good qualified candidate and an employee who's a rock star. And they want more of us, so it's changing itself. So what we do is, what are the standards? We teach to the standard, and you got folks who are fully ready, and some who are just not ready yet.
We're out of time. Great conversation, Leroy West. Thank you so much. Shout out to our friend Greg Cunningham and all of our people at the U.S. Bank. This is Al McFarland. The Conversation with Al McFarland, powered by U.S. Bank. We'll see you next time. Thank you, brother.
Thank you so much.